Chapter 5. The Temple of Almatra was bustling with activity by the time Gorm and Caitha returned. Attendants rushed about the gardens and the lobby. Silver Talon mercenaries marched through the halls at rigid attention, clad in the same black leathers that Mr. Flynn wore. They found Niln in the sanctuary, and the High Scribe excitedly informed them that they were summoned to an audience with the king.
"What's the occasion?" Gorm asked.
"We are to be recognized as the Seven Heroes by His Highness. He has also indicated that he will give us our first quest."
"Well, that was fast."
"Destiny," said Niln, wearing a broad smile.
"We'll see," said Gorm.
"The king expects us soon," babbled the High Scribe. "We've only got an hour to get ready."
Wisps of steam drifted from the copper basin in Gorm's room when he took his bath. The water had cooled to lukewarm by the time he convinced Gleebec to get in. The Almatrans had provided him with a coat of shining mail, a deep indigo cloak, sturdy boots, and soft leather gloves. His outfit was complemented by a new round shield, painted sapphire blue, with shining steel braces and a drake hide rim, a couple of gold and brass rings for his beard, and a new steel helmet encircled with runes. They had also provided a replacement war axe, covered in gold etchings and runes of power, but he forgave them for it as he tucked his trusted old weapon into his belt loop. When he looked at the dwarf in the looking glass, he could see Pyrebeard staring back at him, eyes hard, jaw set. He could almost hear the roar of the crowds, almost see the banners with his emblem hanging from every turret in the town. He remembered the smell of summer nights in Scoria, when everyone knew him for slaying the Hydra of Hangman's Grotto, when friendly shouts greeted him as he rounded every corner, when he never bought his own drinks at the bar. Gleebec stumbled into view behind the dwarf, struggling to hike up a pair of breeches beneath his new squire's tunic, effectively shattering the illusion. Pyrebeard was gone. In his place was a clanless drunkard with a goblin for a squire.
"Come on," Gorm said. He stalked past Gleebec into the hallway. "Let's get this mummer's farce over with."
The procession was taking shape when he stepped out onto the palace grounds. Niln sat, mounted on a great white stallion at the head of the line, arguing with a pair of Almatrans in even more decorated robes. Gorm surmised they were the High Priestess and the alternate High Scribe of Almatra. Behind them, Jin and Laruna rode side by side on a pair of chestnut mares. Gaist sat behind them, so stiff and motionless on his black stallion that even the beast seemed uncomfortable. Almatrans and Silver Talons hurried around the heroes, preparing for the procession to depart. Caitha found Gorm as an attendant was helping him mount his own horse, a ruddy stallion with a foul temper.
"There you are," the elf said, "finally. Have you met these people? You're the only one I can talk to."
"Tried talking to a gaist, eh?"
"It's like having a conversation with a mural. I wouldn't even know his name except someone hung a sign on his horse. And that's still preferable to the mages. Anything you say is just an excuse for them to indirectly insult each other."
"I don't know why they're riding next to each other," Gorm said.
"Simple. Neither one will ride behind the other. Is your, squire all right?"
Gorm looked behind him. An Almatran attendant was attempting to coax Gleebec onto a trained mule, without much success.
"Gleebec, get on your mount!"
"Dunabhig a scabber!"
"None of that. We're mounting up. On the mule with you, Gleebec!"
"Prog the root, Spurdy! Tibrin! Dug up Tibrin!"
"No more arguing. Up you go on your donkey!"
Gleebec crossed his arms and muttered something unintelligible, but he allowed an attendant to hoist him atop the mule.
"You speak Shadow Tongue?" Caitha asked.
"Not a word," said Gorm.
"Then how do you know what he's saying?"
"Haven't the foggiest."
"Then how do— hello?"
Caitha was taken off guard by the sudden onset of a bard clinging to her right hand.
"My darling, my flower, you are a vision," said Heraldin, "a sonnet striding among mortals."
"Hand," said Caitha.
The bard walked his fingers up Caitha's arm.
"Your eyes, like pools of jade, your hair a cascade of auburn, a fount of autumn hues, your skin like almond milk."
"Hand," Caitha reiterated.
"Yes, your hands are like doves, gentle and elegant. They said you were a diamond in the rough, a rose among weeds, but their words fell short,"
Heraldin said, impervious.
"Hand,
nothing could prepare me for this moment. Ock!"
Caitha moved in a quick succession of maneuvers, a fast and forceful choreography carried out with a precise grace. The bones in Haraldin's hands crunched, and he sank to his knees, making a sound like a tea kettle about to boil over.
"I guess you weren't prepared after all," Caitha said, giving the bard's wrist another half-term. "Gorm, do you know who this is?"
"It's our bard. Haraldin Strummans is his name, I think."
Haraldin kept making the tea kettle noise, which sounded like eep.
"Well then, bard, as we're contractually obligated to work together, let me give you a few pointers for the next time our jobs force us to speak."
Caitha twisted his hand further.
"I am direct. If I were interested, you'd know it. As I'm not interested, you should know it. And if you annoy me again, you'll regret it in ways that you are only now beginning to imagine. Are we reading from the same scroll here?"
"Eep,"
said Haraldin, but this time it sounded like an affirmative eep.
"Good."
Caitha released the bard's hands and let him collapse into a ball.
"Well, it seems the procession will be moving shortly. We'll talk later, Gorm."
"Aye, good riding," said Gorm.
"Yah! By the bones!" swore Haraldin, shaking his hand. "Did you see what she did to me? I'm going to need a healing potion."
"It was impressive," Gorm admitted.
"She has all the warmth and friendliness of an ice drake," Haraldin said. "And here I thought there might be a little fun to be had on this trip."
Gorm scowled. The bard's callous lechery seemed shameful, but in Gorm's experience, the other races of men did and said things that would make a decent dwarf blush without a second thought. They talked of love in public. They wore their emotions like clothes, and they wore clothes that hid nothing, and they held huge harvest festivals with flowers everywhere. Living among such wanton debauchery had been a culture shock, as it was for any young dwarf leaving the mines, but Gorm liked to think he had grown fairly well accustomed to living among non-dwarves.
"Well, I'm sure you'll find someone on this trip to keep you company," he said diplomatically.
"A wishful thought. The only other woman in our party is the mage, and it's no use trying my luck with the pyromancer. I've been burned before."
"Ha!"
"It wasn't a joke," said the bard, clutching his hand. "It took the temple healer over an hour to regrow my eyebrows."
"All the funnier," said Gorm, spurring his horse on its way.
The procession of the heroes of destiny left the temple and made its way toward the wall, where it took the broad steps up to the pinnacle plaza. Niln led the heroes, while a contingent of silver talons marched on either side, with Mr. Flynn and Mr. Brunt following behind them. Mr. Flynn walked with a relaxed purpose, the kind of gait that says, "Move along." Mr. Brunt stamped along beside him in a manner that added, "or else." Onlookers stopped to watch them proceed. The heroes were heckled by a couple of people who had failed, against all odds, to notice Mr. Brunt. Gorm was grateful for the shield the Almatrans had provided. It gave him a way to hide his face. Haraldin nodded as they rode down the center of Pinnacle Plaza.
"Conveniently, our path to the king runs just beside our ultimate foe."
"What?" said Gorm. "Where?"
"Has no one told you?" Jin asked. "The statue is our nemesis."
Gorm looked back at the old statue in the center of the plaza. The sculptor was a tall man, roughly hewn from black granite, beard streaming in a silent wind, sword held at the ready. His stone face was twisted into an expression that could have been horror, or perhaps rage, his gaze fixated on something unseen at his feet. Gorm had seen the statue 1,000 times before, but had never looked close enough to notice the details of the man. The broad shoulders on such a tall figure, the wide nose, and the flat features of the warrior's face were unmistakable, despite the fact that nobody living on Arth for over 3 ages had ever possessed them.
"It's a sten," said Gorm.
"That he is," said Haraldin.
"How are we to find a sten? They're all long dead."
"Oh, it shouldn't be too hard, once he comes back to life," said Jin.
"Right,"
Gorm sighed.
"Or perhaps we're to kill the sculpture if it animates itself," said Laruna. "The Sten were masters of the old magics, Mr. Ingerson," Niln called back to them. "The magic of stone and bone and blood."
Gorm jabbed a thumb toward the grimacing sculpture.
"So, you think this fellow is going to come to life?"
"Back to life," corrected Niln. "Or return in some other fashion, yes. The prophet Clanesh says that the thrice cursed is thrice born, the third time to unmake what was made. He is the Dark Prince, the last king of the Sten."
"He's a hunk of granite."
Niln didn't seem to be listening. He stared defiantly up at the dark prince's cryptic visage and recited another prophecy.
Blood and tears rain on stones. The weeping of light's children fades as the maiden of tears sings her dirge. This is the music of the Sten's rebirth, the song of Alfadden's rise.
So wrote the prophet Aspeth, Niln finished ominously.
He shall lament the lack of hot beverages, recited Jin. I'm fairly certain Aspeth wrote that one, too.
Gorm shared a smirk with Caitha, and a couple of the Silver Talons walking with the company stifled laughs.
Yes, well, Niln shifted in his saddle, some of the scriptures are more difficult to interpret than others.
They're all equally fatuous, said Jin.
Niln straightened in his saddle and spurred his horse forward.
Careful, Master Jin, Mr. Flynn said from the rear of the heroic procession.
Apologies, Mr. Flynn. I had no idea you were such a believer in the idea of an immutable destiny.
Immutable? Oh, no, sir.
Master, own destiny.
Right you are, Mr. Brunt. The choices we make shape our lives. For example, poor judgment can make a life remarkably shorter.
I see, said Jin.
Not another word was spoken until they were well inside the High Palace of Andoran. The High Palace was set into the side of Mount Windspar, at the very back of Andoran's topmost tier. Marble towers and columns seemed to flow from the white stone of the mountain, spilling around and under domes tiled with navy and burgundy. Crimson and blue banners of Andoran hung from the highest ramparts, but below them were a rainbow of banners from all the city-states in the Freedlands, and beneath hung pennants beyond counting, the sigils of all of the various companies of bannermen. The Silver Talons stopped at the courtyard, marching into waiting formations as Gorm and companions dismounted.
"You leaving us?" Gorm asked Mr. Flynn.
"It would be above my stature to associate with the heroes of destiny in such a manner," said Mr. Flynn, though his wry smile indicated that just the opposite was true. "But worry not, Mr. Brunt and I will be in the audience."
"There's to be an audience?" said Caitha. Mr. Flynn only smiled and waved. A contingent of palace guards, decked in shining steel armor and blue and red livery, took the Silver Talon's place as the heroes were marched through the palace to the throne room. The throne room was a long hall, with high arched ceilings and marble floors that were packed with nobles and servants of every race. There were elven lords and ladies, dwarven fathers attending a prominent ancestor, the dukes and duchesses of the human nobility, halfling emissaries, tinderkin ambassadors, and representatives from the other clans of gnomes. Gorm could feel all of their eyes fall on him at once when the crier announced that the heroes of destiny had arrived.
"I guess this would be the audience," said Gorm.
"It's more like a funeral for our careers," said Caitha, trying to cover her face.
Gorm recognized the polite smirks on the faces of the lightly applauding nobility. It was an expression common to the successful playing host to failures, trying to keep up the appearance of manners while simultaneously hoping for an amusing disaster. Above the cruel crowds, a vision of shining armor and gleaming teeth stood before the thrones, clapping loudest of all. Johan, the greatest hero of the age, the slayer of Azanon and Datar Ermion, the savior of Hap's Bend, the champion of Tandos.
"Didn't know they'd bring in Johan for this," said Gorm.
"Nor did I," said Jin, hiding his eyes.
"They had to bring in the guild's top hero," said Laruna. "It wasn't enough to embarrass us in front of the king and queen."
The king and queen had been prince and princess the last time Gorm had seen them. The years had weathered King Handor from the plump and pleasant prince to a leathery scarecrow in fine robes. Time had the opposite effect on Queen Marja. She could barely fit on her throne. The crowd fell silent as Handor stood.
"All rise," called Johan. "The crown now calls the champion of Almatra, the seventh hero of prophecy, and his valiant companions to come before the court."
"Here we go," said Gorm.
The ceremony began. As far as Gorm was concerned, a ceremony was the most efficient way to expunge the joy and excitement from any event, refining it to the purest tedium. It was like watching a play that he already knew the ending to, only with more dialogue and usually less swordplay. He wasn't sure what quality of a ceremony invited people to speak at extreme lengths on subjects that everyone was already familiar with, but it was probably the same force that invariably compelled some participant to wave a stick or a sword over a small fountain, or a cup of wine, or something extra symbolic. The ceremony kept going. Gorm had stopped paying attention around the point when the king had admonished the crowd about the importance of believing in your own heart, or some other such nonsense. The audience's attention was drifting as well. Their interest had waned once it became clear that the heroes weren't going to do anything spectacularly embarrassing, or at least nothing beyond showing up in the Almatran party. By the time Johann waved his sword over a horn of ale, the air rustled with the sounds of an anxious crowd. Gorm glanced at Niln. The boy drank in Johann and Handor's grandiose words. His chest seemed to swell with every mention of honor and destiny. There may have even been a tear glistening in Niln's eye. The ceremony's end was long and laborious, like a dying beast that refused to be put down. Johann finally ended it with a sharp, decisive declaration that the seven heroes of destiny were officially commissioned, prompting a smattering of applause and a stampede for the door. To Gorm's surprise and dismay, the heroes weren't allowed to leave with the rest of the crowd. Instead, they were ushered through a small door behind the thrones to a small stone room with a round oak table. Gorm and his companions sat around the table, and then rose as Johann entered. They immediately dropped to their knees when King Handor strode in behind Johann, flanked by several attendants. "Oh, none of that, none of that," said Handor. He looked far more relaxed than he had on the throne. "Look, the big one has the right of it," said the king, with a nod to Gaist, who hadn't sat or kneeled or acknowledged the king addressing him. "On your feet or in your chairs, it matters not. The ceremony is over, and we have business to attend to. Johann?" "Your Majesty," said Johann. He pulled a velvet pouch from his belt. It contained a single object, a large, milky white stone. He placed it on the middle of the table, where it stared at Gorm with the weathered remnants of tiny eyes, and menaced him with a tusked grimace. "This," said King Handor, "is one of the elven marvels."
"It's an orc," said Laruna.
"Indeed it is," said the king. "It was likely carved by ancient orcs in the Fourth Age."
"So why do they call them elven?"
"The marbles were ripped from the inner chambers of an orcish temple by the elves of House Tyrieth during the sack of Chief Agruk Bigtooth's fortress," said King Handor. "This was at the end of the last age, in the days before orcs could obtain non-combatant papers, you see. You're familiar with this sort of problem, I'm sure." Gorm nodded. Tens of thousands of orcs, goblins, gremlins, and other shadowkin had decided that it was better to join the margins of society as NPCs than to become a footnote of history. With a growing multitude of reformed monsters walking the streets of the Freedlands, increasingly often a shadowkin would notice a sacred relic or holy weapon long lost to their people displayed in a shop window or hanging from some nobleman's wall. The town criers were particularly enamored with a story about the urn of a revered kobold ancestor that had been repurposed by the High Clerk of the Scorian Heroes Guild as an ashtray. "The orcs and the elves nearly went to war over it years back, in the reign of my father," said the king. "The orcs took the elves to court over it, and most scholars agreed they had a chance of winning. But 3 days before a verdict, the marbles disappeared, and each side accused the other of the theft. The orcs went mad, totally mad. You had NPCs defecting and riling up the orcish tribes over the marbles. We had to put whole armies of them down, all for some rocks that went missing." Gorm remembered it well. In prouder days, he'd led the party that had dispersed a portion of the Iron Bone tribe. He'd even struck the killing blow against their chieftain. "Those statues brought my father nothing but trouble, so I'm sure you can imagine how unhappy I was when the marbles turned up in a wyvern's hoard a few weeks ago," said the king, "and how much more so when most of them went missing en route to Andoran."
"Ah,"
said Niln.
Yes, your majesty.
The Freedlands exist because of one thing, King Handor said, leaning forward. Stability. The people in the streets claim their freedom or their virtue binds our kingdom together, but in a famine you're only free to starve, and in a drought there is no virtue but survival. No, liberty and piety are well and good, but a kingdom needs stability to survive, a healthy stalemate wherein every people, every faction, every city finds the status quo preferable to the price of change.
Yes, your majesty.
I will do anything to preserve that balance. Anything. This theft, this intrigue? Handor shook his head as words failed him.
There are tens of thousands more orcs in Andoran than there were 20 years ago, and already their leaders are wondering aloud who has taken the stones. The elves of House Tyriath have skipped questions altogether and are making bald accusations against the orcs. It is imbalance. It is strife. It is the first crack in my kingdom's foundations. I will not have it.
The king stood.
This, then, is your quest. I charge you to find the marbles and return them to their rightful owners. I care not who those rightful owners are. Give the stones to the elves or the orcs or to the wyvern's corpse, so long as this matter is done and settled and my kingdom is stable once more.
We won't disappoint, your majesty, said Niln. The king smiled.
I know, he said.
He nodded to Johan and took his leave. Johan put the lone elven marble back in the velvet pouch, took a small maroon binder from a waiting attendant, and handed both to Niln.
This is the first of the elven marbles, and the file with all our information on the missing four. You will reunite the set and put them in their proper place, wherever that is.
I accept this quest, said Niln breathlessly,
his face rapt and reverent as he accepted the marble and the documents.
Ha-ha! I like your spirit. I wish I could stay and chat, but you know how it is, Johan said. It'd be good to catch up with a few of you. Gorm and Aheen, I'm looking at you two. It's been too long, guys, really. Let's have lunch after all of this. And you, what was your name again? Is it Keitha?
It's Keitha.
Johan shot her a wink and a winning smile.
You and I should definitely get better acquainted sometime soon. Great ceremony. Great team. It's going to be great. I know it. Tandos bless you.
Ha-ha!
With a swirl of his crimson cape, Johan was out the door. The seven heroes, plus one goblin, sat in a perplexed silence. Even Niln looked puzzled, the awe and wonder draining from his face as they sat quietly.
Is that it? He asked.
An attendant placed a scroll bound with a scarlet ribbon on the table.
You'll find these documents lay out the key objectives of your quest, she said. We've taken the liberty of scheduling a meeting with the ambassador from House Tyriath for the day after tomorrow. I'm told a Mr. Flynn will have the details.
I was just expecting something a little more, said Niln, clutching the pouch and the maroon binder.
It's just not what I was... I mean, we're the heroes of destiny.
It was almost a question to the royal attendant.
Yes, well, right now we need this conference room, said the attendant, making an apologetic face. I'm afraid I have to ask you to continue your meeting elsewhere.
The heroes were ushered out of the room and directed down the hall. Rather than follow the others, Gorm excused himself and set off down the stone hallway in the opposite direction. Gleebec came skittering after him. Something didn't settle well in his stomach. It was good that the job was a simple fetch quest, and it sounded more dull than dangerous. Years of adventuring had taught Gorm to appreciate an uninteresting adventure. Fewer heroes came back from the exciting ones. But as good as the quest for the elven marbles sounded, it didn't make any sense, and only one man had answers. He caught up to the man in a small atrium at the top of a short staircase.
Johan!
Gorm called up to him.
Oh, Gorm! Look, I really do want to catch up, but no time to talk. You can thank me for getting you the gig later.
You can spare a few minutes for a hero of destiny, said Gorm.
Wait, you recruited me for this Almatran nonsense?
Well, we had the Silver Talons recruit you.
Ha-ha! But I was the one who suggested it. Like I said, thank me later.
I ain't thanking you, I'm blaming you.
Johan's perpetual grin finally broke.
You... I thought you'd be ecstatic.
Oh, aye, I'm sure you hired mercenaries to haul me along because you thought I'd be ecstatic for being wrapped up in the Mad Queen's schemes.
Hey, listen, I knew I'd need some muscle to keep some of the heroes in line, said Johan. People worry about career and image and things like that. A couple of union thugs helps them get their priorities straight. But you, and I say this as nicely as possible, you don't really have that problem, right? What career or image do you have left to damage? I mean, you're traveling with a goblin, Gorm. No offense, little guy. Ha-ha!
Gleebuck!
I thought you'd jump at the chance to clear your record, said Johan. It's the chance to be a hero again, the chance the guild never gave you. You could get a few points, make it back in the game.
Aye, back in the game for long enough to get cut down in some sort of lunacy. You know what happens to Almatrans on quests? It usually involves cleaning them up with a mop.
Yes, but this is sponsored by the Temple of Tandos. We're not going to let that happen.
And there's another thing that don't smell right. Why are you Tandosians helping the Almatrans? Why is the king involved? Why send the prophet of an insane goddess on an important diplomatic mission? You ain't playing straight with me.
All right, said Johan, holding his hands up. He dismissed his attendants with a nod and turned back to Gorm once they were out of earshot. Look, the Almatrans have a problem. Johan leaned in, speaking low and close and fast. A second high scribe pops up and starts stirring things up with more seventh hero prophecies. The Almatrans don't want another batch of dead heroes on their record any more than you do. Plus, most of the last wars between the Almatrans and Tandosians were started by so-called seventh heroes, and nobody thinks the Almatrans can survive another war. And then King Handor has a problem, because this business of the elven marbles is blowing up. The markets are down, Gorm, and the king's coffers are emptying. The last thing he needs is some strife between the elves and the Shadowkin. So, I had an idea. The Temple of Tandos sponsored this seventh hero, and now we get a say on where he goes and what he does. The Almatrans can save face, because if he doesn't like his quests or his treatment, they can blame the Tandosians for holding him back. Do you follow?
Aye, said Gorm, still reluctant. So why put him on an important quest?
Because at the end of all this trouble, someone is going to be angry that they didn't get all of the elven marbles, be it the orcs or the elves. By appointing the seventh hero to sort out the business and choose who gets the stones, we make sure they'll be angry at you, or the Almatrans, or maybe even the Tandosians. Ha! But they won't blame the crown, or at least not as much as they would have. And that's the key. Stability.
True, said Gorm.
Everybody wins, said Johan. The Almatrans are spared embarrassment, or even a war over this seventh hero business. The Temple of Tandos avoids an unsightly conflict with the Almatrans and gains influence with the king. The king gets to hand this headache with the marbles to somebody else, and you and your friends traveling with Niln get your careers back on track after one simple fetch quest.
Aye, but only until Niln dreams up some sort of suicide mission, said Gorm.
Gorm, if he does that, how do we benefit? People knew the last seventh hero was mad once he took on the dragon, and it was a public relations nightmare for the Almatrans. Why would I want that for my own temple?
I suppose you wouldn't, Gorm conceded.
I definitely wouldn't, said Johan. I just need you to be on board with this one job. You settle the matter of the marbles, we declare your quest a success, and then we say the seventh hero is awaiting his destiny or something. You can even take on other gigs while you wait. You'll have a career again.
Just one quest, said Gorm.
All that stood between him and his old life, the good life, was finding a set of rocks and handing them to the elves. That's all I'm asking, said Johan. Unless that statue comes to life, then we might have to call you up again. Ha ha!
Ha!
Possibilities danced before Gorm's eyes. The Khazad Im clan might take him back in. He could see his brothers, visit Da's urn at the ancestral shrine. He might even make it to this year's Feast of Orchids, if they could finish the quest in time.
I'll do it, he said.
Ha ha! I knew it, said Johan. That's why I chose you for this mission. I know that in the end you'll always do the right thing.
Aye,
Gorm nodded, barely listening. They'd need more training, of course.
It was just a matter of managing personalities and getting the combat dynamics down. They could start preparations tomorrow, tonight even. With any luck, he'd be catching an orchid in the autumn festival.
"Look, I can see you're already excited about the job," said Johan. "I'm excited. This is exciting! But I really need to be going. Are we good?"
"Aye," said Gorm, momentarily surfacing from his plans.
"Aye, we are."
"Great. And let's keep this conversation to ourselves, shall we? The whole plan will kind of go south if Niln gets wind of it. I'm sure you can imagine."
"Aye. I'll not speak of it. I... thank you, Johan."
Johan's teeth gleamed an uncanny white.
"Don't mention it, Gorm," he said. "I'm counting on you."